I'm going to kick off now by introducing our first international opening speaker for the keynote address. Now, first of all, I will introduce Andrew Rayner, and then I'll tell you what he's going to be talking about. So Andrew's just flown in from South Africa, and the first day he was pretty good, but he tells me jet lag kicked in last night, so hopefully he'll stay awake long enough to give us his fantastic presentation. He's the Chief Risk Officer and Chief Actuary Group for Discovery Limited in South Africa. His role spans all the group entities, including South Africa, UK and global partnerships. Discovery Limited, it's a fascinating business. It's a leading financial services organisation founded on the principles of customer engagement and wellness. Andrew's a qualified actuary with over 30 years' experience. So he's going to talk to us today about thriving through shared value. This session explores the story of two young actuaries, entrepreneurs, who saw a problem and wanted to solve it. They wanted to solve it because it needed solving, because it would give them freedom to pursue interesting careers and run their own business, and frankly, because it would help change their country. So Andrew's going to tell us about why they did it, how they did it, the challenges they overcame, and how, over 25 years, this has produced a unique business model that has successfully expanded into adjacent industries and across the globe. It's based on the concept of shared value and behavioural economics, and demonstrates how sticking to a values-based core purpose can drive success. Please give a warm welcome to Andrew Rayner.
Thanks very much, Melinda, and good morning, everybody. How are you doing? All good? Great, yes. Melinda, I think you've actually stolen most of my speech content there already, but I'll try and recover. As Melinda said, I arrived on Saturday evening and felt that I'd defied jet lag on Sunday. I felt fantastic yesterday. Long walk from the Spit Bridge to the Manly ferry station and back, and felt wonderful. And continued to feel wonderful until about 4:35 o'clock this morning when I fell asleep. So, if I start to flag, just make some noises or something. So thanks, Melinda. So yes, as you said, I'm going to talk about what I believe is quite a different business model from what we're used to seeing in the financial services sector. It's a business model that, as Melinda said, started with entrepreneurs. And those entrepreneurs who started that business remain as chief executives in that business to this day. And the culture that they imbued in that business is also very much part of that business. It's an entrepreneurial model, as Melinda said. It started 25 years ago. I've only been there for the last 5 years, so I claim no input whatsoever to the success of the business. And anyway, who heard of a CRO making an entrepreneurial business successful? As Melinda said, I want to talk you through some of the reasons for the business, some of the challenges, the approaches that were adopted, and the ups and downs through that business cycle. So as Melinda said, the founding members of Discovery, some of you may even know them. It was two actuaries. They were fairly newly qualified, Adrian Gore and Barry Swartzberg. Now, Adrian was a recently qualified product development actuary at Liberty Life, and Liberty in the day was top five listed company, one of the top three insurers in the market. Adrian developed a passion for wanting to change the dynamics of the private healthcare insurance market. And he took his ideas to Liberty, who were not really that interested at the time in developing them. So he ended up deciding to go on his own way. He was 27 years old. He'd just had his first child. He thought this was probably a complete mad idea, but he felt consumed by the passion to fix this. So what was he trying to fix? There we go. So at the time in South Africa, and some of these problems still persist to this day, there were three key drivers affecting the private health insurance market. The first of those was that it was a high-cost product. It was really only available to an elite few people. And one of Adrian's ideas was to try and make this much more widespread, that more people could participate in private healthcare. In South Africa at the time, there were some really great advances happening in medical science. So any of you that have been to Cape Town have probably heard the story that I've heard 100 times as a newcomer to Cape Town, that Chris Barnard conducted the first ever successful heart transplant in Groote Schuur Hospital in Cape Town. It was a government hospital. There was lots of things happening with AIDS at that time and lots of breakthroughs happening. So there was a lot happening. The medical profession was certainly at the forefront of global medicine. But there was a distinct shortage of doctors. And that led to a very different two-tier medical system, with private healthcare being up with the world's best systems, but government healthcare services being much, much lower and much poorer quality. As a result, there was a huge burden of disease. The years of life lost from the study on the screen here show you that the years of life lost were around about five times in South Africa what they were in a developed country like Australia or the US. So problem number one, we had a very high-cost product that simply wasn't accessible to lots of people. Problem number two was something that it's almost like a law of nature, that medical inflation far outstrips wage and CPI inflation. And this has been proved across all the developed countries of the world and over a long period of time. And I believe that what we're seeing here is the effect of technology actually increasing the cost of a service rather than reducing it. And I think it does that because technology enables healthcare to get out to a wider and wider base of consumers, and it enables treatments for diseases that were previously not treatable. And the cost of those treatments just becomes more and more expensive. So I think you've got an inherent sort of problem with healthcare, with this inflation dynamic that you see. And ultimately, if you take that to the extreme, you're going to find that less and less, fewer and fewer people can afford healthcare. The third element is what we refer to as the healthcare wellness paradox. And I know you're all actually, so you're familiar with hyperbolic discounting. I just thought we should throw that in there. So the healthcare wellness paradox really looks at two sides of the coin. So on the one side, you've got healthcare benefits. And healthcare benefits, the benefits are immediate. You feel sick, you need a surgery or something, you go to hospital, you claim on your insurance. It's pretty immediate. There's not much you need to do as a consumer to consume that service. And the price is hidden. You don't actually incur that cost generally. It's a free service in your perception. The antidote to healthcare provision is wellness. But wellness, on the other hand, has an immediate cost, and the benefits are hidden. The benefits will only emerge over a long period of time. The cost of doing so is immediate. You have to join a gym. You might need to buy equipment. You have to look after what you eat. You have to do screenings and make sure that you're taking preventative measures looking after your health. So you've got this paradox. And this overlaid with the problem I show on the right of the slide here, which is people are generally over-optimistic about their own health and their own abilities, by the way, but sticking to health for now. People are generally over-optimistic. So we find from our own data, when you look at members with higher and higher numbers of chronic conditions, their perception of their own health actually improves. The more of them with more chronics believe they're in better health. So I'm not saying it very well, but... So as well as a high-cost product and something that's just law of nature that will have high inflation, you've also got a product that's overutilized, and there's very little incentive for people to do what's required to reduce the cost of healthcare. And this is the problem that Adrian was trying to solve when he created Discovery. The things that he was touching on at the time have subsequently been validated by clinical studies and other studies. So I quote from one here, which is from the Oxford Healthcare Alliance. And this is a model we often refer to as the 4460 model. And the 4460 model basically concludes that there's four lifestyle choices that all of us make every day. That's to do with nutrition, use of alcohol, smoking, and exercise. Those four basic lifestyle decisions generally drive four, or heavily impact four, predominant conditions, which is cancer, diabetes, heart disease, and lung disease. And in turn, these conditions lead to 60% of all deaths worldwide. When you look at medical benefits, it's actually more like 80% of all healthcare costs worldwide. So The challenge that Adrian and Discovery was trying to grapple with was, how do you change people's behavior? Because if this is the evidence here, then clearly behavior change is way more effective than negotiating with your medical suppliers to reduce the costs. And so Discovery was born in 1992. Some of the, Melinda, when I was brief, said, look, try to bring through some of the lessons learned in terms of the leadership style and values that gave the success of the company and led to that success. And I think this is probably one of the first of them, other than the entrepreneurial nature of the people that founded the business. At the outset of the business, they set down a clear purpose. Adrian was intent not to build an organization built on rules and built on a narrow pursuit of profit. He had a much bigger social agenda. And the purpose that he set down at the start was to make people healthier and to enhance and protect their lives. Aside that, he had a set of values that the founders put together. And there were 8 values that they settled on in that first year of operation. And you'll see them listed on the screen there. And you know, I think some of them that have served us very well and are absolutely prevalent when you look at Discovery now is intellectual leadership. All of our main businesses, the CEOs are generally actuaries. If they're not actuaries, they're clinical, medical people with huge amounts of experience. Intellectual leadership is absolutely dominant in the corridors of Discovery. And I think the last two values there as well are also massive values in Discovery, that of drive, tenacity and urgency, operating with those values, but at the same time with integrity. And then value number 4, innovation and optimism, also absolutely key in overcoming the hurdles that you inevitably do as a startup. So the point I want to make is that this core purpose and these set of values that were set down 25 years ago now remain untouched to this day. There's not been any change in these values whatsoever. This wasn't some result of a McKinsey's exercise, brainstorming using industry templates. This was just the honest feeling of the people that started this business. And the core purpose has informed every single business venture that we've gone into, whether that be in the financial, in banking, or credit cards, or life insurance, and so on. And it's the fundamental core of everything we do. Okay. So in that early days, how did the team start to try and change behavior? Well, the first thing they did was launch a product. Remember, in these days, it was purely a health insurance business that we were into. And they came up with something that at the time was really innovative. And looking back on it, it sounds quite basic, but I guess that's the nature of these things. So what they decided to do to help encourage people to take ownership for their own health and make the right choices, instead of having a pure insurance component to a product, they introduced what was called a medical savings account. Again, sounds fairly simple. But the medical savings account was one of 3 tiers of the product. The medical savings account was something that your premiums went into, you were credited with an interest rate, and at the end of the year or at any time, you could actually withdraw from that savings account. So it was your money. But it was used to meet all of the first tier of all your medical costs. You went to the GP, the optician, the dentist. That was the first call on the policy. And that was then before you got into the middle tier of the policy, which involved co-pays, and then the top tier, which was your pure insurance for the big events in life. And through this product, the idea was that you started to change people's behavior and make them responsible for their actions. Now, what Adrian and the team were touching on here, and what became sort of part of the ethos of Discovery, was that of shared value. Now, in 2006, Michael Porter and Mark Kramer at Harvard published a paper that coined the phrase shared value. And they've done a lot of work on this, and fortunately for us, Discovery's been a part of the evidence they've used in their theory. But the idea of shared value, again, is very simple. If you can get members and policyholders to change their behavior, to improve their own health through their own actions, that will ultimately lead to lower claims costs for the insurer. It gives you a bigger margin. It's pretty straightforward stuff, yeah? The bigger margin then enables you to either make more profit or to plow that back in to shared value with the member and give him better benefits, other benefits, price discounts, and so forth. Through that sort of virtuous circle that you're trying to promote, you then get better selection in the life insurer. And what we see extensively is you get better lapse experience. I mean, there's 2 key drivers to making insurance successful, I believe. One is keeping the claims cost down. The other, given the upfront costs, is keeping policies on the books for as long as you can. There was another participant in the shared value system, and this again was sort of core to the ethos of Discovery, which is that society should benefit too. And if you get this system right, by improving people's health and wellness, you actually reduce the burden on state resources and government hospitals. Bear in mind, a lot of our policyholders in the early days were employers offering sort of a group health insurance to their employees. And again, there's lots and lots of evidence which shows that fit employees and healthy employees are far more productive than those that aren't. So over the early development years of Discovery, this idea of shared value touched on behavioral economics and making people responsible for their own behaviors and reaping the rewards of that. And it led to the development of something that we now call the Vitality Status. Vitality was launched in 1997, sort of just over 4 years after the launch of the company. And it was quite a basic thing at the start. I mean, you did no smoking declarations. There was a limited amount of screening. But the core of Vitality was actually a gym benefit. In those days, it was the only way to really get a validated exercise profile from somebody. Now we all have these Fitbits and gadgets and things, but in those days, that was the methodology. Anyway, through engaging and proving that you were keeping healthy, that gave you a certain vitality status, and that gave you a different level of discounts. Now, the gym component of this was absolutely critical. So as an example of Adrian's different way of thinking and Discovery's style was the ability to turn problems on their head. So in at the time, consultants were coming and telling us, we know how to help you distribute your products. You want to attract healthy lives. You've got a product which is a premium-ish product operating at the top end. You need to find those people. You'll go find those people in gyms. So why don't you have a distribution agreement with gyms to sell your products? And Adrian, in typical fashion, turned the problem around and said, we're not going to do that. Actually, what we're going to do is offer free membership to gyms for our policyholders. And in so doing, really unleashed a huge amount of interest in the Discovery product. Now, the gyms, which were fairly elitist and limited people that could engage in them, were now open to anyone that wanted to buy a policy and start getting serious discounts to the gym. The vitality model has obviously moved on a lot from there and has become much more scientific. So the vitality model is now the glue that puts all our businesses together. So we've launched other financial services businesses since then, and vitality model enables us to take the mortality and morbidity claims data from life insurance, the health claims from the health insurer, the credit card and banking details and spend details that we get, and put those together with the results of screening tests and the results of things like your wearable technology. It's a hugely scientific model, and really the success of Discovery depends upon it. If you don't get the criteria for working through the statuses aligned with the actual health improvements and insurance improvements, then the pricing of your products is completely out of kilter. So we have a lot of clinical expertise, a lot of actuarial expertise. We have big data and data analytics and analytic scientists in this team. And essentially, this is really the underpinning of the whole business. Just quickly touching on one of the other businesses before I show you some of the results of the program has yielded. The next plan for the business was to, in 2000, to launch a life company. Again, it was a case of turning an established business model on its head. I think one of the words you'll hear a lot in our corridors is disruption. So Adrian wanted to be a disruptor, and that ethos is carried through the business. We have a strong sense of being insurgent in markets that we enter into, and never having an incumbent mindset is absolutely the antithesis of what we're looking to do. And a lot of energy is focused on making sure we don't fall into that trap, even when we are quite dominant in markets. So Adrian's view and the Discovery view at the time was the life insurance model is totally broken. If you think about the 4-4-60 model, which basically says a lot of the claims in the early years and the middle years are going to be down to your own behavior, it makes no sense whatsoever to pursue the model where you test people at the point of entry and only then. At that point in time, you decide whether there'll be a good risk or not, and that premium pretty much stays fixed for the duration of that product. What they wanted to do is make a much more dynamic pricing approach where your behaviors directly influence the price that you pay for your policy. So it started with a reasonably big discount, and over time you could either grow that discount, keep that discount, or gradually lose that discount, depending on your engagement in healthy activities. So that led to obviously better selection, and ultimately, you end up keeping the better lives, and you genuinely change the behavior and get people to act differently. That was all based on codified mortality curves, and we call this bending the QX. So the goal is to bend the QX curve downwards, and we apply this to any business that we get involved with, not just life insurance. And I'll show you some data in a moment which shows there's a really clear correlation between higher statuses and the QX curves that we managed to bend downward. After this, we launched a credit card business in 2004. We launched an investment business in 2007. And then we launched a non-life motor insurance business in 2010, all of them based on the same core purpose of enhancing people's lives, making them healthier, and protecting them. Okay, I better speed up. I'm getting the message that we're running out of time. I'm going to give you a quick run through some of the statistics and the data that we see, which we believe is quite compelling. So a program like this requires people to be engaged. And we see significant member engagement across the Vitality program. So on a day-to-day basis, we're monitoring getting data for 70,000 workouts every day through gyms. We're getting over 1 million sets of data from wearable devices. We have a healthy food benefit, which encourages people to buy healthy food, and they get discounts for that. And we see a growing proportion of healthy food spend. In terms of, I'm often asked at analyst meetings, is this model really about just selecting the best lives, or is it about genuinely changing behavior? And the trite answer, I guess, is, well, it doesn't matter. But actually it does. So we do like selecting the best lives, don't get me wrong. But we also have a passion for changing behavior. If you're going to grow the business, it doesn't help just selecting the best lives. You've got to grow the market by getting people healthier. And we see there's clear evidence that once people engage in a program and start exercising, it has all sorts of knock-on effects. They have an increased uptake of healthy food, increased uptake of screenings and preventative measures, and generally much better engaged. Just looking quickly at the data from our various businesses, and I'm just going to touch on two or three. So when we look at the life business, you see some dramatic effects by vitality status. Again, this is just measuring your involvement in exercise and the things that you do, as well as the results of some basic screenings. And you see that the lapse experience of highly engaged members is about a third that of the average member or the unengaged members. The mortality experience is also significantly sloped downwards towards the higher statuses. And you can see here that the cost of health claims and chronic conditions is also significantly lower for engaged members. Looking at our health data, again, you see the profound effect that physical activity has on your experience. So the first graph shows you the number of gym visits and the correlating that against the probability of entering hospital during a year. Again, you've got significant advantages of attending gym. And the cost of non-chronic, so with an engaged member, non-chronic conditions once you've entered hospital tend to cost 10 to 40% less than for non-engaged members. And chronics have a similar pattern. One of the most interesting areas that we've got involved in recently is from 2010 we launched the motor business, and that was based on telematics. The telematics wasn't there to do a sort of a usage-based insurance or a per-kilometre charging. It was there to encourage people to improve their driving health, and that was really by using the telematics device to ascribe a score to you based on your cornering, acceleration, braking and driving style. And giving regular feedback. So you receive messages about where you drive badly and what you needed to do to improve it. So again, encapsulating that core purpose in this business. And again, you see absolutely clear correlations between highly engaged drivers, lower lapse rates, lower loss ratios, and a sustained increase in the behavior change. Again, you'll see there that most people think they're good drivers and only about a third of them are. And then last of all, just before I close off, looking at Discovery credit card. Now, most banks out there will probably use the only credit rating techniques they have are really based around income and expenditure and balance sheets and so on. Now, we've got elements of that in our credit card, but actually one of the key things that we have that banks don't have is access to this vitality data. So through we've mapped here the vitality status, which again is not based on any financial metric. It's only based on your health and your wellness and your activity. How that relates to the credit defaults, how it relates to the spend, and how it relates to the lapses. And what you see is significantly lower defaults under highly engaged lives, higher spend on those lives, and lower lapses of those credit cards. So it's the ultimate sort of ideal customer. So we firmly believe that this model is key to running a credit card book. And that's one of the reasons that later this year we'll be launching a bank as well. Okay, so I think I've come to the end of my time, and luckily my talk as well. So we're pretty sure that we can bend the QXs across all these businesses, and we've got a model that works across those. just in terms of the key learnings, I think I've said them already. I think we aim to build a business not built on rules, not built on a narrow pursuit of profit, but built on a core purpose and a set of non-negotiable values that applies to everything that we do. We operate as a disruptor in everything we do, and we seek to be insurgents and never an incumbent. We operate with tenacity, urgency, optimism, and innovation. And we try and turn problems on their head when we need to solve them. I think I'll stop there, and that allows a little bit of time for questions. Thank you very much for listening.
Okay, well, thanks, Andrew. We've got, I think, a roving mic for questions, and there's also the ability to send questions through that SMS number. Oh, sorry, now you can hear me. There's a roving mic for questions, so if you want to ask a question, please raise your hand or send them through the SMS. I don't have any yet, which probably means no one's sent any through. So please send your questions. I might kick off. I know you weren't there for the entire journey for Discovery, but based on your interaction with the founders, what do you think was the hardest thing for them? Because this has been quite a radical and disruptive change to not just health insurance, but then it's flown through to a range of other financial services. What do you think the biggest challenge was on that journey?
Gee, look, that's interesting. We've had some events that have been big challenges. So in 1999, the business had just listed. And it was only a healthcare insurance business at that time. And the medical aid regulator actually totally changed the rules. He issued new regulations saying that that you could no longer seek any sort of insurance profit from a medical insurance scheme. Essentially, you collapsed them into mutual societies owned by the members. And it essentially completely took the rug out from the business model of Discovery. So they had to redesign the entire business and essentially focus on becoming an administrator to that scheme that we originally had, and as well as other schemes. And that was done through driving sort of a really core of actuarial skills, clinical skills, offering great benefit design advice and pricing advice, and an absolute knockout sort of administration service. So there was a major hurdle to overcome. And I think, again, the ability to turn problems on their head, not to give up, that sort of tenacity just to find a solution. We have, a group exco. So basically all the heads of the Discovery businesses, as well as the CRO, CFO, and CIO, meet every Tuesday. We have a meeting from 12 till 6, and we simply spend that time
6 hours
every week with every CEO in the business.
Wow.
And that's a chance for everyone to have their say. We take a problem and we solve it, and we attack it like a dog until we've solved that problem. And there's a rule in Discovery which is everyone must have their say, but once we've settled on a solution, everybody must subscribe to that and pursue it as one.
Okay. And was that setback what drove Discovery to think about the adjacencies, do you think?
I think so. Look, I think if Adrian was here, I mean, it's our 25-year anniversary at the end of last year, and there was a lot of talk about the founding of the business and so on. And he said he always envisaged this sort of castle on the hill of some sort of description one day, but don't by any means expect that he thought we'd be where we are. So I think a lot of it's accidental. I think you start something, you do it very well, and you see an adjacency and you follow it. So I don't want to credit them with too much foresight.
Okay, we've probably got time for one question. Yes, there's one down the front here. If we can have the mic, please. Do we have a mic? We don't have a mic. Okay, I'm going to come down and you can say it into my mic. Talk here.
Okay.
We're agile.
I'm just interested in starting a business like that. You need capital. How did the guys go about it? That's my first question. I guess I'm interested also in the relative success in the South African market. What percentage of the market do you have in the different businesses in which you operate?
Okay, thanks. Yeah. So the capital, the seed capital was 10 million rand in 1992. So that's $1 million today. And that was spent very judiciously. And I think through gain, and the business has grown organically. So we've had two rights issues. We had a rights issue, I think, of 400 million rand in 1999 when it was listed. And then more recently, when we had to buy out the Pru in the UK from a joint venture that we started, about 1 billion rand. So it's all been internally generated through profit and retained earnings. So we have a very low dividend ratio, as you can imagine. for an organically grown business. So you don't buy Discovery share for the dividends, that's for sure. It's a real growth story. And then you asked about the market share. So in the medical schemes business, the Discovery Open Medical Scheme is the largest medical scheme in South Africa. We administer about 50, that's about a 55% market share of open scheme. And then the other schemes we administer come to about 40% of the closed scheme market. So we're pretty dominant in both of those, but not incumbent. In the life market, we're writing about early 30% of all risk business, non-bank assurance risk business in South Africa. So we're the top writer of life insurance. In the motor insurance market, we've got a long way to go. I mean, it's a 5-, 6-year-old, 7-year-old business, and it takes a long while to break in. But we're in the top three writers of new business in all of our markets that we operate in. So it's one of the metrics that we use. We have to be top three writer of new business in all the markets. I hope that answers your question.
Well, thank you. Look, I know we've had a really short time for questions here. Fortunately, yeah. Andrew will be with us for the day and we'll be at the cocktails this evening. So if you think of more questions, he's very happy to answer them. Please join me in thanking Andrew.
Thank you.